that happened fast. I'm like, oh, yeah. Try to get up and say something. Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah Beth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
Great to be here. I so appreciate being asked, and there is little I love more than talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And coincidentally, there's little I love more than Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, when I speak at a meeting, like lots of drunks like me, I say a prayer before I speak, and I don't plan anything, and whatever comes out, comes out. And I trust that process totally. And maybe by the time I'm done, you might come up and say, well, you shouldn't. But, you know, that's what I've always done, and I learned in here, I don't fix what ain't broke. And so I'm just going to start talking, but I'll say first that I'm 48 years old, and I've been sober for 25 years. I got sober the second time. After coming into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, like many people do, feeling like I'm really happy that this fellowship is here for you people, and I didn't feel like I belonged here. But, you know, as what happens with many of us, I now feel like I belong here more than I belong anywhere, and I can't imagine my life without this program. So a lot of times people speculate about whether they'd even be here, be dead, or what they'd be doing. I have to say that I can't even imagine. And I don't think about it much. I've spent much of my adult life in AA, and I grew up in AA, which I think we all do in our own way, whether we come in when we're 18 or 22 or 82. Having the chance to be here for me just one day is a gift beyond measure. So my home group is As You Like It, which used to be the 10 o'clock meeting at Martha Jefferson Educational Building, and then that building changed ownership, and we stayed there for a while, and the group has recently moved up to Pantops, to the First Step Building. And my sobriety date is March 29th, 1987. My sponsor's name is Valerie, and she lives in Baltimore, and that's where I got sober. And, well, I guess technically I got sober in Southern Maryland because I was in college down there, but I sort of sobered up by the skin of my teeth right before I graduated in May. So I sobered up in March and graduated in May and then went back to my hometown, which is Baltimore. And I spent tons of years in AA there, going to tons of meetings. And when I was down in Southern Maryland, I remember that we rode around to three different counties to get to a meeting every day. And when I moved to Baltimore, we had 1,000 meetings a week. And there's only 2.5 hours between the two places. Isn't that wild? So I don't know how many meetings are down there now, probably quite a few more. But at some point in my story, I always mention that when I came into AA, I had this moment where I thought, Jesus Christ, it has come to this. I was looking at the two dudes that I was spending a lot of my time with, and, you know, when I can't remember exactly how old I was when I had this thought, but I know that I was around my 20s, or, you know, early 20s, or some late teens. I don't even know exactly when it was in that time frame because I'm terrible about the exact details of the chronology. But I was hanging around these two old men, and they were old because of my age, and I think they were probably in their 60s, but they felt really old to me. And I was looking at those two guys, and we were hanging out in the Dunkin' Donuts or whatever the donut shop was down there, and they kind of dressed funny and talked funny and talked about weird things, and We all smoked cigarettes and drank coffee, and I just remember thinking, this can't be right. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it turned out to be the rightest thing. And I don't know what I would have done without those two guys. And I seek out guys like that all my life in AA. I can spot them from a mile away. And I try to be a guy like that in someone else's life. You know, because it wasn't so much about the external stuff. I mean, I was distracted by the external stuff. Because what I've learned for me in AA is if I don't want to hear the message or anything, I can just look at all that stuff. Like I used to walk out of a meeting when somebody was cracking their knuckles too loud or slurping their coffee. Don't be slurping your coffee now. I'm going to walk out. No, I don't do that. I don't do that anymore. I'm thankful that most of the time I don't even notice. Sometimes I do. But that kind of stupid stuff would run me out of a meeting. And now, really, you really couldn't run me out of a meeting. And I know that in a lot of different towns where there's AA, you know, there's a lot of cultural differences. Where I lived and went to meetings for a couple of years in South Florida, it was considered highly rude if you came to a meeting late. Not by the little pocket of diehards, not by the little pocket of old-timers, but by everybody. And then where I came into AA, there was an overwhelming sentiment of the one that I have now, which is, it's great to be on time, but you're never late for an AA meeting if the drunks are, you know, in the parking lot. The meeting's over and the drunks are in the parking lot and they're still standing there. You're never late until those people are gone. And I have been helped by many an alcoholic meeting after the meeting, standing in the parking lot where I knew I couldn't get there, but I came sliding into the parking lot hoping just to catch one or two drunks standing there talking, knowing that if I came in and did that, it would be as if I was there the whole time. Now, that doesn't mean that I do my program like that, so I don't show up in parking lots for 2 minutes and say that that I made a meeting, even though I felt like I did in my heart. I don't know if that makes sense to people. I see a couple bobbing heads, so probably does. But what works for me in my program is to do the best I can, and sometimes I really feel like the best I can is enough, and sometimes I feel like the best I can needs some attention because I need to strive for something better. So one of the things that I love about AA is all the slogans. And I used to hate all of those, like a lot of people who love the slogans. And, you know, they don't all fit, but that idea that you're never late for an AA meeting until the doors are locked up and the drunks are gone, that probably doesn't apply to the speaker. Wait a minute. But I was on my way here way later than I would normally be, knowing that I was speaking, and it drove me nuts. And what I was thinking about was that I was really grateful that it drove me nuts, because there would have been a time that I wouldn't have cared. I might not have shown up. I would have considered it a burden. I knew I shouldn't have told those guys I could go do that. I mean, there was a time that I would have been thinking like that. And instead, I was thinking how grateful I was that I was able to get my butt up here, even, you know, 2 minutes before the meeting started. So a little bit about my alcoholism is that when I came into AA, I listened to all the people around me and thought my alcoholism was quite different. And what I didn't know at the time was that that thought alone made me a lot like everybody in the room. I know that a lot of us have fought our drinking patterns and behaviors and thoughts around it and everything were different from the others. And I was pretty sure mine was, because I was around a lot of people who had lost their jobs and their marriages and gotten DWIs and gone to detox, and I just couldn't even fathom what any of that stuff was. I didn't even know what a detox was, actually, when I came into AA. And I looked around at those people and I thought, I don't have alcoholism, because if this is Alcoholics Anonymous and that's alcoholism, I don't have it. But like I was mentioning earlier, many of us can hear what we want to hear and be deaf to what we don't want to hear. And what I didn't want to hear or see was anything that was in the big book or anything that would describe the way that I drank or thought about drinking. The catch was for me is that I had been drinking like a fish, scaring myself to death and deciding to stop drinking before I wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think by the time I showed up here following a boy, you know, following a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy into the meeting, I had been about a year without taking a drink, and so I really didn't think I needed it. I was like, see, I'm not drinking, and if you guys need it, great. But that's not what alcoholism is about. For me, my alcoholism was about having an idea about alcohol that social drinkers don't have, having an idea about how I was going to drink and not being able to drink that way. And when I was sober, obsessing about alcohol and compromising all kinds of values when I was sober, actually, more than when I was drunk. A lot of people I knew compromised their values when they were drunk. I was compromising mine when I was sober, trying to get my hands on alcohol. One of the slogans I heard in AA was, Skid Row is placed between the ears. And that really spoke to me at the time that I heard it. I'm sure it would have fallen on deaf ears earlier on. But for me, I wasn't getting drunk and dancing on the tables and waking up with people I didn't know and, you know, getting into fights. I mean, I did get into fights. I've said in here many times that I got into a lot of fights, but I got into fights because somebody smaller than the person fighting was getting their butt kicked, and I inserted myself to protect someone. I didn't walk around and get angry and pick fights with people. And I would insert myself in this kind of fight sober. So it didn't matter to me. But, you know, my high school friends would go out and drink on the weekends and kind of bring the alcohol along as something entertaining to also do. In my mind, it was the focus of the whole entire thing. And I became really obsessed with, was there going to be enough? And was it going to be the kind I wanted? And if it was the kind I wanted, if it was the kind that I didn't want, then that would stink, but then I would drink the rot gut or whatever it was. I knew that I was going to do whatever I needed to do to drink alcohol. And if you would have asked me about that, I would have denied it. So I knew it, but I didn't know it. And when I came into AA, there was a lot of people who knew what I meant by that. So, you know, so I obsessed about alcohol, like clock watched, you know, when am I going to be able to get a drink? I would go to parties and steal the alcohol out of the refrigerator, you know, which is bad form. you go to a party and there's this unspoken rule that, you know, you're not supposed to be drinking anybody else's anything. Everybody puts their own stuff in the fridge and thinks it's going to be no problem. The alcoholics in the bunch don't think that at all. I mean, they often think, well, I'm not putting mine in the fridge. I got my own cooler, and I'm going to strap it to my back and lug it around and then take yours. And everybody didn't do that. You know, not all alcoholics are like that, but I can assure you that I was. And I mentioned before in a meeting that I was the kind that would drink up your booze and, you know, help you look for it, that kind of thing, when you realized it was gone. And that's probably a couple reasons for that, but, and that's not the only way my alcoholism showed up. You know, I started a lot of sentences with, I'm just going to drink, I'm just going to have a I'm just going to, whatever, I'm just going to have a couple of these, I'm just going to have a couple of those, and I wound up having way more and doing all kinds of things that weren't part of my plan. I mean, I got sober when I was really young, and I was in college, I was writing papers. And on Friday nights, the bar was about 20 minutes from my dorm. On Friday nights, when I was drinking, I would take a break and go zooming up to the bar to get a shot of something. And right when you open the door, the bar was right there. So I would go up in my pajamas, fling open the door, step in, you know, pound the table, order the shot, throw it in, and drive back and do my homework. Keep doing my homework. And that would be like maybe once on a Friday night. And in the small time that I was drinking there in college, it turned into Thursday night and Wednesday night, and Tuesday night. And then it turned into twice a night. And then it turned into, I don't want to write my paper. I'm going to drink beer and smoke pot all night long and try to figure out what kind of lie I can tell tomorrow to get out of it. And it was just all kinds of scheming and things like that. So I woke up in a ditch. Well, I didn't wake up in a ditch. I drank one night at a party, and I drank grain alcohol, and I didn't know I was drinking it, and I drank a lot of it, a lot. And I wound up walking down the street and falling into a ditch down there in southern Maryland. And a bunch of guys picked me up and carried me home, and I didn't remember any of it, and that situation scared me to death. And I'm pretty much a big chicken. There was all kinds of stuff that I didn't want to do when I was drinking because I'm chicken. And even when I was at my most miserable, I felt chicken. I wanted to die. I felt chicken about that. But mainly the reason I didn't want to kill myself was I knew if I was dead, I couldn't drink. that's how bright I was. And, you know, I sobered up because I was scared to death, but if you're a drunk like me, sobering up is not enough. And I found, you know, this, what I heard in AA was if you take the alcohol out of the alcoholic, you still have the ick, and that's what I ran into when I was sober. And I spent quite a while sober without putting the steps into my life and without working any kind of program. And I'm really, really happy when that works for people. I think it's great. It's not like I think AA is the only way to get sober. And I also think, you know, we're not in the business of deciding whether people are alcoholics or not, and we're not teetotalers, and we're not trying to get people to quit drinking. It says in here, if you can, you know, drink like a normal person, our hats are off to you. But for me, it didn't work for me just to stop drinking. And I'm speaking of the relationship with God, that passage that was read in the beginning of the meeting, I grew up in a Christian home, and I had what I thought was a relationship with God. I was involved in the youth groups, and I did a couple things that made me pretty uncool as a youngster, because I was in the youth group, which never goes over well in high school. You're not popular by being in the youth, you know, Christian youth group. And I was also in the band, so that was a double whammy. And I went to Young Life, and I went off to Christian camps. And then when I went off to college, I got involved in Christian fellowships on campus, and it was a small campus. And that was a really important part of my life, and a version of that still is today. But I didn't think what was going on with my drinking and what I felt like had anything to do with God. It was kind of like the last thing I was going to do. Like, I might pray my normal prayers about whatever I might be feeling, but I couldn't make the link that in my drinking, my body and my mind and my spirit were being affected. And my alcoholism was not only about what happened when I drank, it was also about what happened when I didn't drink. And I couldn't function as a sober person in relationships smoothly and conduct myself in a way that was productive. And I was just thinking that this isn't how I was raised. I was raised you know, I say when I talk at a meeting, I was raised by Warden June Cleaver. I mean, my parents, my upbringing was the happiest one around me. And every kid that I knew would have killed for my upbringing. So it wasn't like I wasn't taught how to take care of myself, how to take care of others. It was that, for me, once that alcoholism took root, it was that untreated alcoholism and all the manifestations that it has in my heart, in my mind, and in my relationships. I didn't do well. And after hanging around, not putting the steps into my life, not really bridging the gap between my drinking and my misery and my spirituality. And, you know, there's a capital G God in all this literature. And what I learned is the reason why it's like that is we, as a fellowship, voted to leave a lot of the literature in its original form as it was written in the earlier days. And so, you know, there's a lot of language that we might change or some stuff that we might change if we were going to redo it, but we decided as a group not to redo it. So, but there's a lot of focus in the big book about finding a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And like I said, I just couldn't make the link. So I started doing things like buying alcohol and keeping it in my fridge. Just in case I had company over, and I spent time hanging around people who were drinking. And it's not that I think we can't do those things if we're sober and we're spiritually fit, but I wasn't. I was walking around with that ick. And there's also, for me, the idea of even if I am spiritually fit, how long can I stay in certain situations and stay spiritually fit? And for me, it's not very long. Like I was telling someone on the way up that I don't keep alcohol in my home. And everybody doesn't have the option of doing that. And when I didn't have the option of doing it, it didn't matter. I didn't get up in the middle of the night and drink it. Because I have a program in my life that works for me today. But since it's my house and I don't have any drinkers there, I keep alcohol out of it because it's everywhere else in the world. And I'm just the kind of drunk that might be saved by those 10 minutes it takes me to drive down the road and buy a six-pack of beer or something. So I don't keep it in my home. But anyway, so I started, you know, when I was younger, I started keeping it in my home and hanging around people who were drinking. And before I knew it, I had created situations in my life where taking a drink seemed like the best solution for what was going on for me. And not only was it the best solution, I deserved it, and it was about time, because I'd gone long enough. I'd proved that I was not an alcoholic. And, you know, I've heard in here many people say the way they responded to proving they were an alcoholic was by taking a drink. That just seems, you know, let me celebrate my 30 days by taking a drink. See, I did it. That just seems like the most natural thing in the world to many of us. And I picked up a drink and sucked it down like it had been no time. And that moment was about the only alcoholic thing I did right away, was suck that first drink down. And I think I drank normally. I don't even know because I don't trust my judgment. I think I drank normally for a couple of months, but in short order, I was off to the races. And any number of things that had not happened to me the first time started to happen to me right and left. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that I didn't have a compromise. I didn't compromise a lot of my values when I was drinking. I compromised a lot of them when I was sober, trying to get alcohol. All of a sudden, I was compromising all my values left and right. And I've described my alcoholism as rotting me from the inside out. I've seen a lot of people who were kind of beaten down from the outside. I mean, literally, like, they, you know, you show them and they're like, nose is broken. You see them and their nose is broken and their car's all dinged up in 20,000 places. And I remember this woman at an AA convention talking about her alcoholic house coat. And it was like this little frock that she wore that had like cigarette burns in it and spit up stains and pee stains and, you know, spilt alcohol stains. And I'm like, I don't have any of that. And that's how hers went, you know, all that kind of external stuff until finally on the inside she couldn't take it anymore and she had that moment of clarity. I had it come in the opposite way, where I rotted immediately on the inside, didn't know who I was anymore, and it spread slowly out that way to affect all the areas of my life. So one of the things that happened that was kind of a godless thing for me was I was in a relationship where I was being smacked around on a regular basis, and I don't know how old I was. You know, like I said, I got sober when I was like 23, so I was pretty young, and I had remembered saying in high school that if I got in a relationship, I told my boyfriend when I was like 16, if you ever smacked me, I would be so far down the road, you would never get a chance to apologize. And that's how I viewed the whole situation. And several years later, I was in a relationship where I was kind of getting smacked around on a regular basis, and I couldn't get out. And I know that those kinds of situations have a dynamic of their own, but the dynamic for me was my alcoholism. The dynamic for me was this absolute resignation that I was going to be stuck doing this crap for the rest of my life and I was never going to be able to change it. And nothing that I heard in AA was going to be big enough to fix it. Now, isn't that interesting? I'm like, I'm glad this program is here for you people. And then just a couple, several months of drinking, nothing in AA is big enough to, you know, all of a sudden, I don't have those kind of problems first. And then all my problems are too big. You can't possibly be the solution. And I remember sitting on my couch drunk in my trailer that I was living in by myself thinking, I'm going to kill somebody and I'm going to go to jail for the rest of my life and I don't care. And that was what my alcoholism sounded like and felt like to me at the end. I don't know how I wound up coming back into AA, you know. I knew I needed to be here and every single morning I woke up and I couldn't not drink. I woke up and I'd say, I'm going to come back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to quit drinking, and I'd be on the bar stool by 5. That never happened to me before. I don't know what I was thinking about before the meeting. I was thinking about my nevers and how they're really not yets. And I know that I'm in a much better place in my sobriety if I'm calling them not yets than I'm calling them nevers, than if I'm calling them nevers. But I got a fight. I got in a fight out in front of the bar, and I got my butt kicked this time. And it was so interesting to me that I was getting my butt kicked because I was getting my butt kicked by my alcoholism too. And I spent that last night drinking in that fight. I got knocked flat on my back in this parking lot of this bar. And I remember lying there thinking, the old guys in AA told me didn't have to be this way ever again. And I looked up at the stars, and it was black and peaceful and beautiful up there. And I turned the corner. I don't know what happened. I had a moment of clarity. I got up and dusted my butt off and walked away, and really I haven't looked back since. I've been in meetings constantly since then. And a lot of people stand up, and when they talk about a long stretch of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, I haven't gone to meetings consistently for 25 years. I went for a while, and then I slacked off, and then I was active with my steps, and then I slacked off, and then I did my service work, and then I slacked off. I love when people talk about that because it takes all of us. Just like we have all these different kinds of alcoholics, we have all these different kinds of help people, how we do our program. But there are some programs that I've seen that I think I would get drunk on if I was working those programs. And the reason I know it is it's how I feel when I don't work my program the way I've already decided or learned has worked for me. I've always been an avid meeting maker. And I've gone to meetings religiously, a lot of them, for all of these years. I've always sponsored people. I've always had my head in the big book. And you know, I've got a lot of friends who are like, I can't stand to be around the big book quota. I think that's excellent because there's somebody else who can't stand to be around a big book quota either. And if they were coming in new, they wouldn't take it from me. They wouldn't want to listen to it from me. you know, how we're all different. Some of us got sober when we're young. Some of us got sober when we're older. Some of us go to meetings like crazy people, and like what I did, in a van with as many people as we could shove in there and drove all over the place and then spent as many hours as possible in Howard Johnson's, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee till 3 o'clock in the morning after the meeting, and that's how they do AA. That's how I did AA. And plenty of people just come in, go to the meeting, do their thing, have a little service work, sponsor a little bit, go home. To me, that's a beautiful thing because it all works. But for all this time that I've been in here, I started reading the book. I didn't memorize it on purpose, but I read it enough because I heard things in AA that didn't quite make sense to me. And I wasn't sure they were AA. I wasn't sure they were the message of AA. And the way I found out what was the message of AA and what kind of wasn't was just by kind of looking in the book. I don't know if that makes sense, but I would get confused about things. And I think the message of AA is a really simple one. And to me, it is, you know, all these cliches that I've heard people say, find your own God in your own way in your own time. Clean house, trust God, help others. Find a relationship with a power greater than yourself, even if the power greater than yourself is this group of drunks. And when things are kind of in the crapper in your life, turn your attention toward someone else who needs help. And when things are going really well in your life, turn your attention towards someone else who needs help. And that's truly what has been working for me and what's been keeping me sober. And much of the time, it makes me really happy. But even when I'm not happy, I have a peace inside that I never, ever, ever, ever had when I was drinking. And that's just something that I wouldn't want to trade today. But that feeling that I wouldn't want to trade it has to also be maintained. Because I can stand here and be like, I wouldn't want to trade that today for anything. And if I don't take care of that, then I might not even remember that I felt that way a month from now. So it isn't like I think this is anything that sticks. When I worked my steps, I did them as thoroughly as possible, and I did a crappy job the first time I did a fourth step. I mean, I don't even know. You know, it doesn't matter how long your fourth step is, but most of us don't write a half a page. Most of us write way more than a half a page, and it's okay to write a half a page if that's what you got, because it's not about the quantity. But I only wrote a half a page because I didn't want to look at anything. And I just was like a little scribble, scribble, scribble about the human experience, not about me and what I did. But that was enough at the time. That was my effort. That was my honest effort. And as I kept coming back, as people directed me to do, and I listened to the people who had come before me, and I turned my attention toward other people, as also the slogan says, more will be revealed, more was revealed. And as I came along, I thought, you know, I think I'm going to have to write about that. And I would talk about it first, and my sponsor would say, you need to write about it. And I'd say, I don't want to put it down on paper because then someone might see it. And she would say, someone's going to see it, me. You're going to tell it to me, you know. And actually, I never threw anything away. I know a lot of people set their four steps on fire and stuff like that. Put them through the shredder, I don't know, mail them to the North Pole. But I've always kept mine because I found it a useful tool for me when I'm sitting down talking to someone else. And tell a lot of stories about how I've screwed things up in my life or how I've screwed things up in my sobriety. And I use myself as an example a lot. And I kind of think, God, I talk about myself a lot. And then I realized, oh, yeah, that's the AA way. It's like we don't tell people. I don't tell people what to do. There are some people that tell people what to do. Like, I don't want to be sponsored by someone who tells me to go do something. And I realized one day that probably that person is telling you to go do something because what they really mean is this is what I did and it works. So that's kind of more about how I grew in AA, was not so much listening to the messenger, but listening to the message. Because I could get really picky, like, don't you tell me what to do. Even if I did ask you to guide me, don't you tell me what to do. You know, and everybody's programs are different. Everybody's relationships with their God are different. Their drinking was different, that kind of stuff. Upbringing is everything for us as AA members. It comes down to the same 12 steps. Somebody I was listening to this morning was talking about the click that happened inside. I think she was talking about the click that happened when she was drinking. You know, you would get to that point, whatever that point is, where it's just like completely relaxed for a second. I don't know what it was, but she was also talking about how she had that click in recovery, too, where she was coming around to AA meetings and really not knowing anything about anything, not talking to anybody, and she followed directions even though she didn't want to, and then she had a moment where it clicked. And it got me thinking, you know, I was thinking about how sobriety is like a zipper. I like a lot of metaphors and images. Sobriety is a lot like a zipper, and so is alcoholism. And some of us are zipping up, you know, we're like zipping up, and some of us are unzipping. But either way, that sort of click, 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 click that happens is kind of, for me, what's been my ongoing experience on my spiritual path. Just when I think I might not ever feel God again, I feel God again. Just when I think I'm never going to lose faith, I lose faith. You know, just when I think I'm not going to sponsor another frickin' person. Ever. And I'm going to get up in a meeting and I'm going to say, all you people who don't sponsor people, you better start sponsoring people because you're the reason I have to sponsor all these people. Because you're not sponsoring people. That's really the AA way, isn't it? That's the kind of person that I can turn into. But I think just when I think that I'm not going to something in AA, I wind up doing a ton of it. And that's exactly how it looked in my alcoholism. Just when I think I wasn't going to do something anymore, you know, I'm not going to throw up in this toilet bowl anymore. I would get in a fight and somebody would put my head in it, in the toilet bowl. Or I would drink so much that I slept by the toilet bowl. You know, so anything like that. I mean, and it's that the like spiritual opposite of that has been my experience in AA. You know, I mean, the way that I worked on my relationship with God in AA, even though I had all this upbringing, is when I was in all these groups, and I like groups. That's probably why I'm so happy in AA. When I was in all these groups, I was taking all the direction I could find. And I would just take direction and take direction. And what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? And can I read this? And let me go to that. And let me learn about this. And I didn't do things. And that's the thing about AA. It's like when my sponsor says, Sarah Beth, you need to take your inventory, I'd go, okay, wait a minute. No, take out your pen and put it on a piece of paper, you know. No, I'm thinking about it. No, don't think about it. Write about it. Well, why do I have to write about it if I can think about it? Because writing about it is not the same as thinking about it. Why not? And I would start going on this whole thing trying to figure something out instead of just writing about it and then knowing that writing about it is not the same as thinking about it. I didn't want to write about it to figure that out. I wanted to think about that to figure it out. And that's like, it seems like that doesn't take a rocket scientist, right? It must, because almost every drunk I know does some version of that in their you know, in their personal program. You know, get on your knees and pray. Get on your knees and pray was a suggestion that I got. I can't tell you how many hours I sat up in the stupid Howard Johnson's talking to this guy about how I didn't want to pray on my knees. That I personally found it way more effective to pray flat on my back like this. Because I felt with my back on the ground and my chest to the heavens that I was like a God and earth sandwich. And the guy's probably like, you know, like we are in AA, like listening. And the thing is what's the beautiful thing about AA is that's perfect. That's perfect. It wasn't for, what was wrong with me was not that I was praying on my back like a God and earth sandwich. What was wrong with me was that I didn't want to take direction about anything. And that's what was wrong with me. I don't know if that makes sense. That's a subtlety. That is a huge subtlety that can really make a difference in whether or not I digest this program. And so what I've learned is that my God doesn't care if I pray on my back or pray on my knees or if I say, like, formal prayers from 20 churches or if I just say, God help me, or Jesus Christ, what are you thinking up there? I say that too. But what has worked for me is the willingness to cultivate that relationship and to be real in it. And there may be somebody, like, we would have like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different situations right here in this front row where other people have completely different experiences of prayer or God. I was just in a meeting the other night where people were talking about prayer and meditation. And it was like one of those meetings where you couldn't get called on it. There was too many people sticking their hands up that there were three-hour meetings, you know. So many people had so much to say. And to me, that paradox about having so much to say and this being a fellowship that doesn't have an agenda about religion or God blows my mind. Because it's one of my favorite things about AA, that we don't have an agenda. We're not trying to get you to stop drinking. We don't care if you drink. We don't care if you're an AA. Actually, one of the things that really helped me when I came back into AA was realizing that you don't care if I'm an AA or not. Now, you personally may be my friend and you may love me and you don't want to see me be an idiot or be, you know, go into active alcoholism. And you may know that going to meetings and being an active part of AA is really helpful for me in staying sober. But the fellowship as a whole doesn't have an opinion on that. And that's really healthy for me because when I was out there drinking again, all those people I knew in AA were staying sober. And one of the things that I felt was that the AA hayride was going on without me, that I had bounced off the back and I was lying in the dirt and there they went. And I didn't like it. And I started following directions. And so when I didn't talk about the hayride tonight, but I used to talk about it a lot. And when I was in the back, you know, I would say I was in the back of this AA hayride, and the old timers would be like, Sarah Beth, sit down. Sarah Beth, get away from the door. You know, Sarah Beth, do this, do that. And I'd be like, oh no, I'm doing it my way. Ching, right off the back end, you know. And when I came back in, I was like marching in line. And I wasn't marching in line because AA says march in line. I was marching in line because I knew it's what I needed to do to keep my program together. So I'm just really in love all the time with how different we all are, how different we interpret this program, how different we come to know our relationships with, how differently we come to know our relationships with God, but how it all comes down to the same idea of forming something with a power greater than ourselves and turning our attention towards someone else. What time is it? Time to shut up right now in about a minute. Okay. I did finally get around to doing a thorough and relatively insightful fourth and fifth step. And I loved what I found there because it was awful. And I knew that if I found stuff that was awful, I was probably doing it right. And all the things that are on my fourth and fifth step are pretty much still my traits today. And what I can do today that I couldn't do then is when I'm scared out of my mind, which in a way isn't that often, because it's not like, well, why bother staying sober for all this time if you're still the, you know, miserable whatever you were when you came in? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when I become afraid, I have tools, and I become afraid way less often. But when I am afraid, I am scared to death, and I am petrified like I was in the very beginning. And so now I don't have to say, well, I would, to my sponsor, well, I would write down my fears if I had the kind of notebook I like, but I'm really picky about my notebooks, and I'm picky about my pens. So let me just go pick out my pen and my notebook, and I'll get back to you. I'm like in the bathroom pulling off the toilet paper and scrounging around asking for a pen where I can sit down and write out my fears list. And when something's bothering me right in the middle of the day and I get a resentment, I'm like writing down somewhere what my resentment is. And I'd say 95% of the time, putting pen to paper addresses it immediately. Thinking didn't do that for me. I could think about that resentment and think about that resentment and think. And when I put it down as a resentment and I figure out what the hell I'm afraid of, and I say to myself, Sarah Beth, do you really think that God is not going to take care of that for you? And I'm like, no, that's not what I really think. Well, then stop acting like it is. And I can pull myself together. And then I can fall apart 10 minutes later, and I can write it down again, and I can be like, Sarah Beth, do you really think, is it really your belief that God's not going to take care of that for you? And a lot of times it's like, no, it's my fear. Or it's my fear that God's going to take care of it for me, but it's going to be a lot of pain first, and I'm not going to be able to take it. And how much pain have you had that you haven't been able to take so far? Zip. I thought I hadn't been able to take it, but I was able to take it. And so my fears and my resentments have run me around, you know, kind of grabbed me by the neck and flipped me all over the place. But today I'm not, they're not the boss of me. And neither is my alcoholism. And I don't turn a blind eye to it. Like I said, I don't keep alcohol in my house because I want an alcohol-free zone. But if I'm spiritually fit, like the big book says, I can go anywhere and do anything. And I do all kinds of stuff. I do stuff that I never, ever thought I would be able to do. Can't keep a job sometimes. Can't keep my house clean sometimes. Get mad. I was so mad at myself today that I was spitting nails. And I start down that road. You know, you've been sober a long time. If somebody saw this house, if someone saw this room, they would probably have you committed. That's not a road to go down. That's like really dangerous thinking for me. The road to go down that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me is that I can ask God for some strength and some patience and some grace, and I can put the bat down. And I can pick up one little corner of this room and feel grateful about it. And then I can pick up another little corner and then another little 2 feet. And on a really good day, I can ask you to come help me. And I can transform the room in a day or two. And if I would have drank over it or shot my head off or whatever it is that we do, well, you know, I don't even know how to finish that sentence. All I know is I think it's something huge and awful, and I get through it. And not only do I get through it, I feel better, and I grow, And my experience, and in my experience, I'm able to help someone. And some of the freakiest things that I've ever gotten myself into have been life changers for other people. So I am going to shut up now, and God knows what I talked about, but all I know is there was a time when I thought, Jesus Christ, it has come to this, like I said, and every day I get up and I think, I can't believe I get to be here. I can't believe I get to be an AA. I can't believe I get to be my frickin' age that I am and have as much time as I have. I mean, what's that about? I don't want to blow that, I don't want to blow it. It's not like, oh, my big ego, I don't want to blow my sobriety. It's like, this is a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I try to act like it today, have my head, heart, and hind parts in the same, all in the same place. And that's working. So that's it. Thanks.